Well, this morning we are heading into the study in the book of Exodus, the second book in the Bible. We started last week and went through the book of Genesis, and our intention is, Lord willing, to survey the entire Bible in a year. So I hope you're reading along with us and following along, and we believe that every word of this book is God-breathed, and so we want to go through it as a whole to get a vision for what God's word says. And I hope that this will be helpful to you and a blessing to you, because everything in God's word has something to say to us. It becomes kind of frustrating to go this fast, and yet we want to get the big picture. And so I think that's a good thing for us to do, and I'm going to try to stay with that discipline. The first five books of the Old Testament, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, are collectively called the Pentateuch, or called the Law, or the Torah, as the Jews call it. And it's this section that takes us from creation. As we saw last week, the book of Genesis starts with creation, and it ends with the children of Israel living in Egypt. Now, Exodus, as we see today, is where they leave Egypt, leave their captivity under the leadership of Moses, and move into the wilderness to Mount Sinai, where they receive the law of God, his commandments. The book of Leviticus is a deeper survey of that whole law. And so Leviticus happens at Sinai. The book of Numbers happens when they leave Sinai and head to the border of the Promised Land, and they spend 40 years wandering in the wilderness because of disobedience. And then the book of Deuteronomy is Moses giving them a series of lectures about this whole time period, building up to the time when they will go into the land that God has promised to them when we get into the book of Joshua. So that gives you kind of an idea of where we're at in these five books. Last week, we ended with the children of Israel in Egypt. Today, we'll see them delivered from Egypt and ending up at Mount Sinai. And next week, we'll look a little more detailed at the law itself, and then we'll see them journeying to the Promised Land, and in another few weeks, they'll be entering the Promised Land. So Exodus chapter 1. Now, the book of Exodus is an amazing picture of something that's very important. This weekend, we have over 200 guys up in the mountains at the men's retreat, and the theme of that retreat is leadership. And we had a great time up there Friday and Saturday just reflecting on leadership. Exodus is the best book in the Bible to demonstrate principles of leadership, because Moses was almost unquestionably the greatest leader in the Bible. He was a reluctant leader, as are all effective leaders. He was someone, though, who was able to take over 2 million Jewish slaves and get them out of captivity and lead them right up to the border of the land that God had promised for them, dealing with all of their nonsense, all of their complaining, and everything else. And we see him as amazingly effective. If you are in a home fellowship, you'll see the discussion questions that'll be on the webpage, and we focused on some of these aspects as we go through it. But the book starts in chapter 1 with the children of Israel going to Egypt, as we saw that Genesis ended there. And it says ultimately in verse 5 that there were 70 people plus Joseph in Egypt as their time in Egypt began. The 400 years that Abraham had prophesied that they would be in Egypt, or it ended up by the time they left, 430 years. But you went from 70 people to where by the Exodus, which is what the exit, Exodus is a Greek word for exit, when they exited the land of Egypt, they had over 2 million people, 600,000 men of military age. And so it had to be at least 2 million people total. Now, that is amazing multiplication, especially when they got into debt and were primarily slaves. But the Jewish people were responsible for building many of the great structures of the culture of Egypt. perhaps working on some of the pyramids, but certainly we know on some of their aqueducts and other buildings that we see listed historically and in the scriptures. What was happening, though, is they grew strong because they were working so hard. And God blessed the nation and they multiplied. So the Pharaoh was threatened. And we see that in chapter 1. He's like, we got a problem here. Because we started with a handful of Jews, now we have 2 million of them. And they are our strongest people. Because while we're sitting around just eating luxury food, these guys are working hard. And they said, if somebody goes to war against us and they can turn the Jews against us, we're in big trouble. And so Pharaoh ordered that when a Jewish woman was giving birth, that the midwives would perform a partial birth abortion on any male child, and that they would let the women still be born. And so, which is unusual historically, usually the more men the better, but in their case, they were having a problem with it. He intended to wipe out their ability to be a threat. And it's just one of the first of an entire history of the world of people trying to kill Jews. People being threatened by the success of Jews. It's what motivated Hitler. It's what motivates all anti-Semitism even to this day. You look at the Jewish people and you go, how in the world do they do this? How do they take over everything? How is it that they dominate the banking industry, the scientific community, every great invention practically that's ever invented? Why is it that the Jews are the best comedians? Why is it that the Jews are the best musicians and actors and writers? And in every way, the if you look at Nobel Prize winners, and see how many of them are Jewish. It's just, even in modern times when the Nobel Prize has come to mean a lot less, you look at the whole survey of Nobel Prize winners, they are predominantly Jewish people. And you go, how is that? Well, it's because God, as we saw last week, promised to bless Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and their seed. And he said, in you, all the nations of the world would be blessed. Well, Satan knew that. And so he has been trying to wipe them out because the prophecies say that one would come through the Jewish nation who would crush the head of Satan, and that's Jesus Christ himself. And that explains all anti-Semitism ultimately. It's a demonic thing, and sometimes it's done in the name of Christianity even, but it's a demonic thing that causes people to turn on the success of the Jews and to try to eliminate them from society. And so they wanted to kill the babies. The midwives couldn't bring themselves to do it when Pharaoh, threatened to kill them because they hadn't done it. They made up a story about, they go, man, these Jewish women are so healthy that when they start to go into labor, we come running to kill the baby, and they squirt their babies out like watermelon seeds. We just can't get there in time. They're not like these fat Egyptian women who take forever to go through all their breathing and everything. The Jews just, they're out, And so he bought that. So then he said, okay, well, after the kids are born, if it's a boy, throw them in the Nile River. Now, you remember the story, I'm sure. Moses' parents, when Moses is born and he began to grow, they said, well, the law says, that you need to throw your baby in the river. Now, I didn't mention that most successful attorneys are also Jews. And they said, well, technically, if we stick them in a little boat and put them in the river, we've obeyed the law, right? So they did. And had his older sister, Miriam, keep an eye on the boat as it's floating. Well, the princess, the Pharaoh's daughter, came down to bathe in the river, and she sees this little boat and has her servants go and get the boat, and it's this cute little baby who's been circumcised. He's a Jewish kid. And she's like, wow, this kid's cute. Miriam jumps out, and she goes, oh, you got a little Jewish baby. How about if I get a Jewish mother to nurse the baby for you? And princess is like, sure, I'll pay her to do it. So Miriam gets her mom, and now she gets paid to raise her son Moses. Amazing how God does things. But she raised him until he was older, and then he went to live there in the Pharaoh's court, in his family. And therefore, he learned all of the culture of the Egyptians, which God would later use as he equipped him to deliver the people. But just amazing how God did it. Well, then in chapter 2, you see later on, Moses begins to identify with the Jewish people. Even though everybody sees him as an Egyptian royal brat, as in these days, the kid of royalty usually just gets spoiled. And he was living the life, but he sees an Egyptian guy beating a Jewish slave. And he jumps to the defense of the Jew. He kills the Egyptian and buries him in the sand. Well, the next day, two Jewish guys are fighting. And he's like, come on, man, you guys are brothers. And one of them said, what are you going to do? Kill us like you killed that Egyptian? And he goes, uh-oh, word's out. And the word got to Pharaoh, and it says that Pharaoh was going to kill him for doing what he had done by killing an Egyptian slave master. And so Moses runs, and he goes to the wilderness of Midian. Now, at this time, Moses is about 40 years old. He goes to Midian, which is in present-day Saudi Arabia, the desert that's due east of Egypt. Now, that's also significantly going to be the area in which, as we see, Mount Sinai is located. So after he leads the children of Israel, they're going to end up going where he lived for 40 years, there in the desert. And interesting how, and understand this, when you'll see here in a moment in chapter 3, that God, the angel of the Lord, probably Jesus himself, speaks to Moses out of a burning bush in the middle of the desert. And he says, hey, take off your shoes. The land is holy ground. I'm calling you to deliver the children of Israel. Now, to get a perspective, understand this. Moses was 40 years old. His first 40 years were spent in Egypt, living in the Pharaoh's house. His next 40 years are spent living in the deserts of Saudi Arabia. So he hasn't yet been called to deliver the children of Israel until he's 80 years old. And you might think, man, I'm getting close to 80. I'm over the hill. No, you're just getting started. Because the kinds of experiences that God has given you in your life will serve you well as you do what God has called you to do. And think about it, Moses had a 40-year Egyptian education, which would prepare him for dealing with Pharaoh. He also had a 40-year wilderness training education out in the land of Midian, which would prepare him for those years that he would spend leading the children of Israel through the desert. But it's amazing how God had prepared him. But when God spoke to him in chapter 3, look down in verse 14, God had told Moses, hey, I'm going to use you to deliver Israel from the Egyptians. And Moses is like, well, I don't even think the Jews are going to believe this coming from me. And, you know, and so he goes, who shall I say sent me? I can't go tell the Jewish leaders a burning bush told me he's going to deliver you from slavery. And so God reveals himself as the I am in verse 14 of chapter 3. God said to Moses, I am who I am. I just exist. And he said, thus you shall say to the children of Israel, I am has sent me to you. This is the name that God uses to identify himself personally. Now remember who was speaking. It was the angel of the Lord. The one who ultimately is, I believe, a pre-incarnate appearance of Christ. And he is saying, I am. Now, this pops up again in the Gospels because Jesus is saying this all the time. He says, before Abraham was, I am. It's that word that in the Hebrew, the Jews wouldn't even pronounce it because they thought it was so holy. But it's just that being verb that we usually call Yahweh. When it's used in the Old Testament, sometimes people translate it Jehovah, which isn't an accurate transliteration. But it's that word that we translate Lord in all capital letters. So he's identifying himself as the I am. Later when Jesus says, I am. Over and over again, the Jews wanted to kill him because they knew that by him saying, I am, before Abraham was, I am, that he was saying, I am the angel of the Lord. I am God. And so he gives them this commission. Now, Moses is going, you know what? How am I going to prove to them that I'm your representative? God goes, don't worry, Egyptians love magic. I'm going to give you a couple of tricks you can do. Take your stick, throw it on the ground, and it turns into a snake. Pick it up, it turns back into a stick. Egyptians were huge into magic. Now, this doesn't mean that they had some huge mystical powers. The science of illusionism, the study of doing tricks, is something that was well developed in their culture. And this is still true all over the world with pagans. Most of the time, and though there may be some times where there's really spiritual demonic involvement involved in their magic, most of the time you go and analyze it and scrutinize it and you find out they're just great illusionists. So they always looked for do a good trick. He also said, Moses, stick your hand in your pocket, pull it out. It was full of leprosy. Moses is going, I hope there's a part two of this. Yeah, he sticks it back in and it's fine. Then Moses objects in chapter 4 and verse 10. Moses said to the Lord, O my Lord, I am not eloquent, neither before nor since you have spoken to your servant. I am slow of speech and slow of tongue. That terminology, some people believe that he was a stutterer, and that's possible. So he's like, not only are they not going to believe me, I don't even know if I can get the words out to say what you want me to say. The Lord said in verse 11, who has made man's mouth? Or who makes the mute, the deaf, the seeing, or the blind? Have not I the Lord? Finally, God says, you know, okay, your brother Aaron is a good talker. I'll send him with you. And I'll tell you what to say. You tell Aaron, and Aaron can tell Pharaoh. So God gives a little concession to this. A great leader like Moses not wanting to lead, not only not volunteering to do this, dragging his feet. We tend to think of great leaders as being the type A, aggressive type of go get it, take over person. But biblically, exactly the opposite is true in every leader. There's always a sense of meekness. There's always a sense of, I want to know that God is propelling me, compelling me to do what it is that he's calling me to do. And with Moses, again, he's not like, yeah, I want to do this. That's not a requirement of a leader. It is in the world. In the church, it's exactly the opposite. Jesus said, you're not like the Gentiles. If you want to lead, be a servant of all. And Moses is that way. So he goes into Egypt, and there is a weird thing in chapter 4 I just want to call your attention to, because people will read it and go, well, what is that about? As he's on his way, by the way, while he was living in Midian, he had married a Midianite girl, and Zipporah, who was the daughter of a Midianite priest named Jethro, not Jethro Bodine, another Jethro, you know, this is Jethro the Midian. And well, as they're going, it says in verse 24, chapter 4, check this out, it came to pass on the way at the encampment while they were camping out that the Lord met him and sought to kill him. And you go, God wanted to kill Moses. Where does this come from? But when you see what happens, you can kind of fill in the gaps. Zipporah took a sharp stone and cut off the foreskin of her son and threw it at Moses' feet and said, surely you are a husband of blood to me. So God let Moses up. God had him on the ground ready to choke him out. God let him up at this point. And again, she said, you're a husband of blood because of the circumcision. And then God said, okay, we're ready to go. See, what probably happened is Moses was going to tell the people to obey God, and that included this sign of circumcision. Now, his kids were half Midianite. His wife was a Midianite. She apparently had not gone for the circumcision business. But now, as Moses is going to become a leader, God wants to establish the fact that, hey, if you're going to lead, you have to follow. You can't tell people to do something that you yourself are not willing to do. You need to go first. And so Moses is telling his wife, we need to circumcise the kids. She's going, no. So God's like, this has to end right here. So God actually gets Moses down on the ground, and he's ready to finish him off until his wife goes, okay, fine, fine, fine. She circumcises the boys and throws their foreskins at his feet. I hope you're happy. And God goes, yes. Because a leader has to be someone who follows the rules themselves. They have to go first. And so she's very bitter about it, but Moses shows that he was ready to lead by also being ready to follow. So he goes in before Pharaoh, and First of all, in chapter 5, he and Aaron go in and they go, we want you to, God says, let my people go to the desert and have a worship celebration and sacrifice. And Pharaoh goes basically, you know what, why should I do that? You're taking the people away from work. I need them to get stuff done. We don't have a union here. You're not going to have a holiday for anything. Shut up and get out of my face. And so then he got it even harder on the children of Israel. He began to make them work with the same quotas, but now they had to gather their own straw in order to make the bricks instead of having it supplied for them. So the people are mad at Moses, and verse 21, chapter 5, they said to him, you know, let the Lord look on you and judge, because you have made us abhorrent in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants to put a sword in their hand to kill us. They go, you are not a great deliverer. You're a bad leader. We're not getting anywhere. Things are getting worse for us. Well, God again sends them in, and this time they throw the rod down, and the rod turns into a snake. Then the Egyptian magicians throw their rods down, turn them into snakes too. So they're like, see, we can do it. But Aaron's rod, his snake ate all their snakes. And they go, But God even told Moses, he goes, you know what? Even though you tell him to let them go, and it's gonna happen, he said, Pharaoh's heart, I'm going to harden it so that he won't initially do it. I'm going to have to do a bunch of things before I can get him to let them go. Now, as you read through, I'm not going to read them all to you, the nine plagues before the 10th plague. And each of these plagues, by the way, things like flies and lice and water turning to blood, are all directed at some god that the Egyptians worshiped. And throughout the thing, sometimes it says Pharaoh hardened his heart, and sometimes it says God hardened Pharaoh's heart. So people often ask the question, which is it? Did God harden his heart, or did Pharaoh harden his heart? And the answer is, in both cases, both. Now you go, but wait, how could that be? Well, you can be held accountable for how you respond to someone, and yet you can say that what they did actually brought that about. For instance, I may do something that makes you mad. So you could say, I made you mad. But it's also true that you don't have to get mad just because of what I did. You take responsibility for getting mad yourself. So he uses it both ways. It's kind of like the effect of the sun on different objects. When the sun shines down on mud, it turns it into hard-packed clay, and it dries and cracks. The same sun shines down on a Hershey bar and it turns it into runny chocolate, runny, delicious chocolate. But it's the same sun, and it's like, well, wait a minute, how come it turns chocolate soft and it turns mud hard? Well, the effects ultimately come down to what it's made of. And so because of what Pharaoh's heart was, he was hardening his own heart, but what God was doing was hardening his heart as well. I hope that makes sense. So we go through all these plagues. The water turned to blood, frogs came, lice. Some of them the magicians weren't able to simulate. Some of them they were, which is kind of funny. Like, they make frogs everywhere, so the magicians go, that's nothing, we can do that. They make more frogs. Oh, thanks. Some of the tricks they weren't able to do, they didn't have in their repertoire. As we go through the plagues, as they became more severe, they only happened to Egyptians. Even when it went dark, it was light in the cities where the Jews lived, and it was dark everywhere else. But with each of these, and you can read through the plagues there through chapter 10, Pharaoh would go, okay, ask God to send the frogs away, and then I'll let you go. And then they would do it, God would do it, and then he would change his mind. Over and over again, the stubbornness of this guy became really apparent. And then he tried to get them to compromise. Okay, you adults can go, but leave the women and children here. And God goes, nope, everybody goes. They're to go out into the wilderness and worship God. Finally, it comes to the 10th plague, and this is the one that works. And this was the plague where God said, every firstborn child, including to the animals, is going to die tonight. And you go, that doesn't sound like God. Well, look at everything else that he did, and it wasn't a sufficient motivation. This is something that God knew was going to do the trick. And so it happened. But in order to protect those who believed in God, whether Jewish or Egyptian, he gave them the option. He said, an angel is going to come through at midnight and going to kill the firstborn. However, if you will take a lamb, spotless and without blemish, and you sacrifice that lamb, and then in your doorway of your house, fill the bowl at the bottom of the door with the blood of this lamb. Their houses would have a bowl embedded in the threshold because they'd put water in it. When you come home, you step into the water and wash your feet before you come in the house. Put the blood in there and then take a hyssop branch, dip it in the blood, and put some blood on each doorpost and on the top above the door. In other words, make a cross on your door. Blood at the bottom, the top, over on one side and the other side. And if the angel sees that, he won't kill the firstborn in that house. And so this was called what came to be called the Passover. And God told them in chapter 12 there in verse 2, this is going to start your calendar. The day of the Passover is going to be the first day of the month of Abib. And the Jewish calendar will start with the Passover, as it does to this day. It's called the Passover because the angel of death would pass over those who had the cross on their door drawn in blood. Interestingly, when Jesus hung on the cross, when they gave him vinegar to drink, they dipped it with hyssop in the same way as this. This was clearly a picture of the lamb who would be killed for our sins, eventually Jesus Christ himself. So the Passover is instituted. At the same time, they were to eat unleavened bread after that, because leaven in the Bible is a symbol of sin. And they didn't have time to cook bread that would rise, so they made quick unleavened bread. Same unleavened bread they still eat for the Passover. Same unleavened bread we eat when we celebrate communion. It's to speak of something that keeps. You can take it with you. You can prepare it quickly. And it's talking about the life of holiness that says, I'm not going to clutter it up with sin. So the Feast of Unleavened Bread is instituted here too. And sure enough, it worked. Everybody was going, Pharaoh, let them go, let his people go. And the people were so glad to see the Jews leave, they were giving them jewelry and dishes and stuff, which became the source of gold and everything for all the things that God would have them build for the tabernacle. So they finally leave. And so this happens, and as they take off, it says that the Lord went before them in chapter 13, verse 21, by day in a pillar of cloud to lead the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light so as to go by day and night. In another place, it's called the angel of the Lord who does this. In the daytime, they would be led by a cloud that would provide shelter for them, shade. At night, that cloud would move to the rear of the people and turned into fire. And that would keep them warm in those cold desert nights and would also, again, lead them if they were moving at night. And the scriptures clearly say, Old and New Testament, that was actually the angel of the Lord. That was actually Jesus Christ himself. And so he's going with them. He's leading them. You've probably seen the movie. They got to the Red Sea and hit a snag. Now, if you look at where Egypt is, the logical way to go to Israel is to go directly north. There's a border there today at the Gaza Strip where it meets Egypt. You see all the problems that are coming with that border. Well, in Gaza is where all the Philistines lived, who would become one of their great enemies. They weren't ready at this point to battle the Philistines, so God sent them towards Saudi Arabia due east, and they got to the Red Sea and hit a wall. By this time, Pharaoh had changed his mind, was coming after them. They raised the rod, raised their hand, and the sea opened up, and they were able to walk across the sea. But the people were scared, and over in chapter 14 and verse 13, Moses said to the people, don't be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. The Egyptians whom you see today, you shall not see again, no more forever. Now you see them, now you don't. and the Lord will fight for you, and you will hold your peace. And so the angel of the Lord came before them, down in verse 19. Moses stretched his hand over the sea, it opened up. Pharaoh and his armies, all their chariots, came after them. When they got in the middle of the dry part of the Red Sea, it drowned them. Now, some people would say, oh, at certain times of the year, you can walk across the Red Sea, and when it's windy, it's only like a foot deep. Well, it says they went across on dry land. But if this was some natural occurrence that God opened the sea enough for them to get across, it's an even greater miracle that the whole Egyptian army drowned in a foot of water. So I believe that this was deep. There were walls of water, and it collapsed and destroyed Pharaoh and his armies. So Moses celebrates in chapter 15. He writes a song. His sister Miriam wrote a song in verse 21. Now they came out in the wilderness. They needed water. There was a place called Marah. The word means bitter, because it was water, but it was bitter. You couldn't stand it. But God told them, take this type of branch and throw it in there, and it'll turn it perfectly fine. So they did. He got water for them. Chapter 16 demonstrates manna, that phenomenon whereby God, for 40 years, had bread fall from the sky every morning, and they were able to eat that all the time. Chapter 17 talks about the rock, that when Moses struck it, water came out. And in the middle of the desert, that's amazing. The book of 1 Corinthians chapter 10 says that that rock was Christ. That rock was a picture of Jesus. And that's why later we're going to see, when God tells him to speak to the rock for water to come out, he strikes it again, and God goes, you really messed up. Because Jesus would only be stricken once. He would only be killed once. Then all you have to do is speak to him to receive the water of life. But you goofed it up by striking a rock again. And so, Moses, you don't get to go into Israel, the Holy Land, until the Mount of Transfiguration much later. So water is provided. They get into a skirmish with the Amalekites in the end of chapter 17. They weren't experienced soldiers, but they were strong. But it was amazing that as long as Moses kept his arm in the air, they were winning the battle against the Amalekites. But when he got tired and dropped his arm, they began to lose. So Aaron, his brother, and Hur came and stood there and held his arm up, and they defeated the Amalekites. And it's a great picture of how important it is to support leaders. That when leaders get tired, the role of everyone else is to come alongside and encourage them, not to drag them down and not to slow them up, but to go for it. This is awesome. And so here you see that. In chapter 18, his father-in-law Jethro gives him a good piece of advice, I believe. Remember, Jethro was a Midianite priest. And a lot of people would say, oh, you shouldn't take advice from, you know, non-believers. But in this case, he knew what he was talking about. He came up with a good idea. You're burning yourself out, Moses. You need to get things organized and get some other people involved in doing what needs to be done so that you'll survive and you can do the important stuff. Another good leadership lesson we don't have time for. They finally arrive at Mount Sinai, and Moses goes up into the mountain. Remember, this is the same place that he had lived for 40 years. He knew this mountain. He knew this area. It was where he met Jesus in the burning bush. Now he goes up with some of the leaders, and God begins to give him the law. And in chapter 20, you have the Ten Commandments. And I would love to go into those in detail. I love the study of the Ten Commandments. If you go on the internet, you'll see when I did 10 weeks on the Ten Commandments. And you can check that out. And they play it on the radio every once in a while, too. Then you see this section of some of the description of the law itself as God is giving it to Moses. We're not going to go into details on it because we don't have time. Next week, it's all repeated in Leviticus, and we'll look a little bit more in depth at the law, the nature of the law, what it's supposed to do. But there's a lot of interesting stuff in here. Chapter 21 in particular has some interesting instructions. And you may wrestle with instructions in the law about slavery. And you would think that God would just go, no more slavery. Slavery was a part of their economy, and God gives a law that's practical, not something that's so unrealistic that it's impossible to perform. Slavery in those days was just like having a job. Now, from our perspective, it seems horrible, but God knew what he was doing and so gave them rules about this. There's also a passage there in verses 22 through 27 or through 25 that talks about dealing with if a woman loses her child because of someone's negligence and how that's to be dealt with. It has ramifications in ethical areas that we don't have time to go into, but you can read it and come to your own conclusions. Various property laws, dietary laws, feasts that are instituted, and things like that. Now, in chapter 24, the leaders of Israel who were there kind of with Moses at the base of the mountain gave a response as they heard the law. They were really optimistic, and they said, "All that the Lord has said, we will do." Very naive. The reason the law was given was to show people that they couldn't possibly follow it. So you give them all these rules and they go, "No problem, we'll do it all." See, the right response would have been impossible. How in the world can we ever do this? And then you're ready to understand about grace. The law prepares you for grace. As you find out you can't follow the law, you discover that there is one who did follow the law for you. But that's interesting. Goes into the various offerings, the design of the tabernacle, this moving tent temple that would go along. Now, it gives very detailed instructions when they're told how to build the tabernacle, and then it tells that they did it, and they go through a lot of it again. There are some people who have gone into great detail speculating about the significance of every little detail in the tabernacle. And you can listen to John Corson or Arthur Pink, and there are others who love to go into great details about the tabernacle, Chuck Missler and others. I kind of go to some, and there's a lot of validity to it, but I relate to Dr. McGee, who says, he told me one time, he goes, "You know, when it comes to the tabernacle, I don't know about all that significance," but he said, "I kind of think some of those poles were just there to hold the thing up." So you can come to your own conclusions on that. But all the garments for the priesthood, the priestly garments, the consecration of the priests in chapter 29, as it says, "Kill a ram and take Aaron and his sons and sprinkle some blood on their right ear to speak of what they listen to. Put some blood on their right thumb to speak of what they do. Put some blood on their right toe to talk about where they go." And it's a picture of the consecration that God calls of all his priests, including all of us, that what we listen to and what we do and where we go should be set apart for him and covered by his blood. Now, as we move through, and again, we'll cover some of these things in Leviticus, Lord willing, but in chapter 32, it gets interesting because while Moses is up on the mountain getting the law, and the children of Israel are going, "Yeah, we'll do whatever God says," down the mountain, they're building a golden calf because they worshiped calves in Egypt, and they were going like, "Man, we got a bunch of gold. We're probably going to die here in the wilderness. Who knows if Moses is coming back?" And so they gave Aaron all this gold. He put it in the fire, and he made a golden calf for them. And God knew this was happening, and he got so frustrated, he told Moses, "You know what? Let's just cancel this whole deal." He goes, and over in chapter 32, this is amazing. The Lord said to Moses, verse 9, "I have seen this people. It is a stiff-necked people. Now, therefore, let me alone, that my wrath may burn hot against them, and I consume them, and I will make of you a great nation." God goes, "Forget the Israelites. I'm starting over with Mosesites. I think you're the only guy that gets it." Now, that would be tempting. Really? But look at what, and this is what a true leader does. They take responsibility for the sins of the people. They don't separate themselves and point their finger and blame the people. He goes to bat for the people, and he goes, "But God, you promised through Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Come on, man, please, you've got to do this." A little later, he says, "God, please forgive these people. But if you don't, then take my name out of the book of life as well. If they aren't saved, I don't want to be saved." And an amazing lesson about leadership, about taking responsibility as identifying with the people. Moses is an amazing guy in this respect. So they come down. Moses sees the golden calf. He gets so mad, he takes the original Ten Commandments and throws them down and breaks them. Later, God's going to run off another copy for him. But so they had it. And he's so mad at them, and he goes, Aaron, what are you doing? And Aaron goes, yeah, funny thing. We threw a bunch of gold in the fire, and this calf came out. So Moses says, hey, you know, I've had it. He stood up in front of the people in verse 26, chapter 32, and said, whoever is on the Lord's side, come over here. And the Levites were primarily the ones who came over here. And he goes, now you guys get your swords and go wipe out people who are behind this stupid calf. Kind of awkward for Aaron being the leader of the Levites, but at this point he must have apologized. And 3,000 people end up getting killed. Interestingly, the day the law is given, 3,000 people are killed. The day the church was started in Pentecost, 3,000 people got saved. The difference between law and grace. And so he goes to bat for the people. Down in verse 32 is where he says, if you're not going to forgive them, just blot my name out of your book. I'm out of here too. And so then in chapter 33, another great passage about the relationship that Moses had with God. After he got the new, you know, the another copy of the law, he had a tent where he just used to get alone with God. And that incredible verse down in verse 11, so the Lord spoke to Moses. This was in his tabernacle of meeting. The Lord spoke to Moses face to face as a man speaks to his friend. Now, he couldn't see the face of God, but they were saying that's how close he was to God. And then he'd go out to the camp, and Joshua would hang out at the tabernacle. Joshua, this amazing guy who comes out later to be another amazing leader, was being mentored and taught by Moses. And verse 15 of chapter 33, Moses said to God, he said, you know, if your presence doesn't go with us, we're not going anywhere. And then in the end of that, beginning of verse 18, God, I just want to see your glory. Please show us your glory. Show me your glory. God goes, I can't let you see me completely. It would kill you. But go in a cave and I'll go by really fast. And you'll see the shining of my presence as it passes by. And that happens again there on Sinai. And Moses gets the new tablets and goes down. The covenant is renewed there in chapter 34. There's rules about the Sabbath day, some other rules. They begin to construct the Ark of the Covenant, which is this portable temple. Becomes a model later for the temple, but this one was movable. And so that's all constructed as you go on towards the rest of the chapter. The priest's garments are made, and ultimately the thing is erected, and they're ready to depart from Sinai. They're ready to move to the promised land. Unfortunately, their rebellion messed it up. But next week in Leviticus, we will see more details about what happened at Sinai. But again, Moses stands here in Exodus, and it's hard for a guy to write a book about himself and still be humble and still be meek, but Moses does that. He shows his own failures. He shows his own inabilities and incapacities and doubts, but he shows, here's how God used me to lead this thing that was completely above my head, completely out of my control, and an amazing lesson and testimony. And so I hope if you haven't read Exodus, I would encourage you to just go through and read the whole thing. You might come up with some questions. You can always get a hold of me, and I'll try to help talk you through those things. But it's a great chapter. Now, when we come to Leviticus, I'm probably not going to tell you read every word. Go through and scan it and get the gist of it, because it gets rather detailed about the law, but I'll try to next week, Lord willing, go into some of the elements of the law so that you'll understand what sacrifice is about, so that you'll understand what worship is about, and so I know that's going to be a great time as well. So there, I made it only 5 minutes over. I was 10 minutes over first service. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for your word. Thank you for giving us an example of a guy like Moses. Most of our examples of leadership that we see are arrogant, egotistical, self-serving, boorish, pushy people. But you gave us an example here of one who truly leads with you, by your Spirit, according to the angel of the Lord. Thank you for these lessons. Thank you for this deliverance, because, God, it speaks to us that when we are entrapped, when we are enslaved, that you can set us free too. You can lead us out of our slavery and to a place of freedom. And we thank you for that in Jesus' name. Amen. Let's all stand. If you're here today and you've never accepted Jesus Christ, and being a slave in Egypt is an appropriate image for you of the way your life's been going. It just feels like you're not getting anywhere, and the harder you try, the harder it gets. I have good news for you. There is someone who sacrificed himself for you, and his name is Jesus. He died for your sins so that you can start over and receive his forgiveness. He wants to lead you to freedom. He doesn't want your life to feel like slavery. He wants it to feel like freedom and like you're going somewhere. And if your life feels more like slavery than freedom, I encourage you, there'll be people down here in the front who would love to pray with you. And they'll pray with you for any reason. If you've given your life to the Lord, but you're still bound up in Egypt, come down and get some prayer. Don't hurry out of here if what you need to do is just come before God with your situation. So I pray that you'll do that this week. And I pray that this week too for all of us, as God has called us to influence others, that we would learn from the example of Moses and we would live lives of leadership over our families, over our friends, over people we work with or go to school with, that in every way we will say, you know what? We are going to do what God tells us to do. And we're not going to serve ourselves, we're going to serve God. May we live a life of that kind of example, and it'll have an amazing effect on those around us. God bless.